Swings, a slide, monkey bars in a sandbox. They're simple things that make for endless possibilities of childhood activity. But what if your neighborhood doesn't have a playground? A study recently documented that while Kansas City's low-income neighborhoods are teeming with parkland, those neighborhoods are much less likely to have parks with playgrounds. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll take a close look at how playgrounds are distributed in our city. We'll also meet some parents who have taken steps to build a neighborhood playground where there hasn't been one before. Hang with us on Central Standard, right after this news. Luce Park has one of the most popular playgrounds in the city, and Dion Hardiman can tell you why. He lives about 5 miles from here, and sure, there are other parks, but he likes to bring his daughters here.
My two daughters wanted to come and play in the swings and everything, and play in the sand and everything, and you don't get a lot of that in the other parks that you go to. Me, myself, I believe there's not enough playgrounds, like say off of Purcell and off of Truce and little small parks, there's not enough places like this for young kids to play at. It's the sand and the water and how they have like tall ladders and things to climb, and like other places they go to, they don't have things like this in other parks.
The benefits of playgrounds are legion: social skills, problem solving, self-care, and a sense of connection to peers, to place, to community. So how are communities affected by the absence of public playgrounds? And why do some neighborhoods have easy access to these resources while in other neighborhoods they're few and far between? Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, starting this week with a trip to our city's parks. We'll be speaking with someone from Parks and Recreation and a neighborhood mom who has organized her community to build a playground. But our first guest this morning is researcher Katie Vaughn. She's with us by phone from Kansas State University. Katie participated in a study of parks and their amenities in Kansas City, Missouri. For that study, she personally visited all 219 parks in town. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
That sounds like a lot of parks, 219, and we're hearing a number 220 as well. Is that a lot of parks for a city our size?
Yes, it is quite a few parks, and I'm proud to say that it was very enjoyable to visit all of them. Not all of them, however, are usable as parks, but they are all designated spaces that I have been to.
What do you mean by not usable as parks?
Some of the parks were just ravines, so they weren't safe for people to go in. For example, they might have a big ditch with just trees in it, or maybe they were a cemetery, and so that's obviously not usable for physical activity.
Are those facilities that are listed as parks if you looked up a list of parks in Kansas City, Missouri?
Yes, they are. And that's we received a park list from Kansas City, Missouri Parks. And that's how we started with the 219 parks.
Well, tell us a little bit more about who WE is. Tell us about the study you participated in and what you were investigating and why.
Right. I was a research assistant with Dr. Andrew Kaczynski. He's now at the University of South Carolina. And he and another research assistant, Gina Bassini, and I, they wrote a grant to Active Living Research, which is a program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And they were assessing a lot of different aspects of parks, and they were also looking at how to assess parks and compare parks not only within cities but across the nation. And so they wrote a grant to create a park audit tool and then to use the park audit tool to audit the parks. And I came in at the ending stage of the creation of the park audit tool, and at that point Gina and I were sent out to all the parks to use the tool.
That sounds like a fun assignment, and if I ever go do research, I would like that job. But I will get back to my questions about this. What is a park audit tool? Describe what you created.
Well, it's called the Community Park Audit Tool, and basically it is kind of a checklist that anybody can use it. You don't have to be a researcher. And you just tick off the amenities and the facilities that are there in the park. For example, how many soccer fields are there? How many baseball fields? Is there a water fountain? Is it usable? Is the park in good condition? The playground, is the playground multiple colors or is it all one color? Just that type of thing. So it's just basically a checklist. And then at the end, you can kind of go through and review and compare parks based on the facilities and amenities that are present at each park.
These all sound like fairly intuitive questions, but the playground being multiple colors intrigues me. Why is that significant?
Some past research has found that parks that are more than two colors are more pleasing to children. Therefore, they'll be more likely to play on that sort of a playground.
How did you personally get involved with this project?
Well, I was a new student at Kansas State University working on my master's of public health, and I was invited to help out, and I just kind of dove right in with the other research assistants.
What does this have to do with public health? Because I feel like there are some dots we might want to connect here. What do park amenities and public health have to do with one another?
Well, parks are, for the most part, always free, and they offer many different ways for folks to get physical activity throughout the lifespan. So it's very important as a public health effort for a community to have parks that facilitate physical activity and energy expenditure among children, families, just everybody, because they're free and available to everybody.
What were some of the differences you noticed from one park to another? Were they surprising?
I don't think from one park to the next it was necessarily surprising, but just general trends were a little bit more surprising. For example, there might be different types of facilities in different neighborhoods or in different cities across the United States.
Well, within Kansas,
have more.
Let's focus on within Kansas City. What were the trends that you noticed within Kansas City as you compared parks across various census tracts?
Mm-hmm. Right. So we did look at the different census tracts, and what we found that the lowest income census tracts contain significantly more parks than the higher income census tracts. But also within the lower income census tracts, which did have more parks, there were fewer parks with playgrounds, and there were more quality concerns per park.
What are some examples of quality concerns?
Quality concerns would be things like litter, lights that maybe don't work, drinking fountains that don't work, places that it would be hard to see. So, for example, if you're sitting on a bench, you couldn't see maybe a certain part of the park where that would be a danger to small children.
So just anecdotally speaking, did you see people behaving differently in the parks in ways that corresponded to the differences, or did you not have an opportunity to observe things like that?
We didn't have too much of an opportunity to observe that. We were going pretty rapid fire throughout the parks. We visited upwards of 8 to 10 parks per day, so we weren't able to spend a really significant amount of time looking at the neighborhoods surrounding the park and interacting with any of the citizens who would be using the park.
When exactly did you make all of these visits? What years?
It was fall of 2010 and spring of 2011. We had to split it up because of winter. It got a little bit cold to be visiting parks.
And did you return to parks more than once, or did you make one visit per park?
We made one visit per park, but there were some parks that were visited by a test auditor prior to when we audited the park, by people who were ensuring reliability of the community park audit tool.
Well, for yourself and your fellow researchers, as having done this tour of Kansas City's parks, what do you feel like are the main points that you take from this experience? I mean, how would you assess our situation, especially with respect to playgrounds?
Well, I would say that Kansas City is really lucky to have the amount of parks that they have. And this experience really made me realize how important parks are, not just for physical activity, but for neighborhood aesthetics and just the general feeling of the neighborhood. I feel like a good park can really make a neighborhood great. And as just personally, it made me definitely want to use parks more and definitely made me feel like when I have children in the future, I want to live in a neighborhood that has a wonderful park for my family to visit.
Well, let's turn now to Gene Kotlinski with us this morning from Kansas City Parks and Recreation. He's the South District Superintendent. Hi, Gene.
Hi.
Well, what does a parks superintendent do?
Well, the parks superintendent is in charge of basically the maintenance and operations of their district. We have three air superintendents basically that take care of anything from mowing grass, picking trash, cleaning playgrounds, cleaning picnic shelters, just over basically the maintenance and operations of our district.
And where exactly is the South District located?
The South District boundaries begin at Brush Creek and go all the way to the south part of the city. So everywhere from Luce Park, Swope Park, down to Ruskin Heights, down to Migliazzo in the south part of the city, everything from, like I said, Brush Creek South.
So when we heard that clip at the beginning of the show from Luce Park, you got to have a little moment of pride there?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I imagine some of this question of how playgrounds are distributed goes back quite a ways, that the parks in many cases are old and the playgrounds either were or weren't built in them a long time ago. But how do you respond to this information that you hear in this study about playgrounds and parklands?
Well, that's true. I mean, we are, an older city in the central part of the city, and some of our parks are needing playgrounds, and we are actually working that way. We have 11 new playgrounds going in this summer, and actually 12 if you count the one that we're going to put in Swope Park.
So is that just within the South District, or is that in all of Kansas City?
That's throughout the city. We are having 12 new playgrounds put in, and anywhere from Sunnyside Park, we're actually having...
Where is Sunnyside
Park? Sunnyside Park is at 83rd and Summit.
Okay.
And in the Northland, we're actually having new playgrounds in Inglewood Park, Davison Park, Crestview Park, Clayton Park. In the Central District, we're having a new playground in Roanoke Park, Parade Park, and Garrison Park. And in the South District, as I mentioned, Swope Park, we're going to have one right near the Kansas City Zoo entrance. And, matter of fact, the Kansas City Zoo is also putting a brand new playground inside by the Discovery Barn. And besides, I mentioned Sunnyside Park, we're going to have a new one in Ruskin Way Park, Blue Hills Park, and Hibbs Park.
That's great news. Well, do you hear from people in neighborhoods where playgrounds aren't available? Do you get, like, complaints, requests for improvements?
We have a program in the city called the PIAC, a Public Improvements Advisory Council, and citizens can request through that process a playground in their neighborhood or replacement of a playground in the neighborhood. Again, most of these are replacements of an existing playground. For example, Sunnyside, that I'm familiar with, is probably close to 20 years old. That has been requests of the neighborhood, requests of myself, requests of the park department of getting that replaced. And, you know, funding it's been tight here the last couple of years, and we're fortunate enough to actually work through game time. We're actually on these 11 playgrounds. We actually had a matching grant program that we were able to purchase these through game time.
Could you explain what some of those things are? What is green time?
Game Time is actually one of the manufacturers of commercial playgrounds, like PlayWorld Systems and Landscape Structures and things like that. So they're one of the big ones across the country.
So you mentioned that part of how this process works is that you, in fact, might request a playground, or that the Parks Department might request a playground. How do you as, you know, you're not members of the neighborhoods necessarily, how do you as a part of the Parks and Rec Department come to the decision that a certain park needs a playground or needs an improvement?
Well, you know, we all of us as managers, when it gets to the budget year, and our budget proposal to the city manager, we go through a process of looking at our playgrounds and assessing which ones need to be replaced. Most of what we do in the way of the park department, in the way of requesting new playgrounds, is usually to replacing ones. When it comes to a new one, most of the time that's the neighborhood requesting a playground in their neighborhood park, and that's usually through the PIAC process.
And you mentioned PIAC a little bit, but what's the process like of procuring the funds to actually do these things? I mean, I would imagine that a high quality, safe playground is not an inexpensive investment.
Exactly. No, they are not cheap. But it all depends on, of course, the size of the park. For example, Loose Park is a 75-acre park, so you know you can put a large playground in like we have. You get into a small, you know, 2-acre neighborhood park, it's not going to fit a big-sized playground like that. So it's all going to be based on the size of the park and, of course, the funding that's allotted for that request. But, so different parks are going to take a different-sized playground. Playgrounds are also kind of designed for either a 2- to 5-year-old or a 5- to 12-year-old. Some of our parks, some of our smaller parks, just maybe have a two to five year old playground. It's mostly for the smaller kids, for toddlers and things like that. And if it's a bigger size park, such as Loose, you know, it's a combination. So there's a section of the playground that's a 2 to 5, and then there's a section of the playground that's for the 5- to 12-year-olds. So again, it's going to be based on, a lot of it's based on funding. A lot of it's going to be based on, you know, the size the park has and where, you know, the, you know, I mean, if it, you know, for the park is hilly and, you know, it's got to be able to fit into the park, you know, so of what is desired, you know.
You mentioned a good handful of new playgrounds being built in Kansas City, Missouri just this summer. Are any of those playgrounds new, totally new playgrounds, or are they all replacements?
I think they're all replacements. The Crestview, I think the Crestview and the Inglewood in the North districts, I think those are going to be new locations that don't have an existing playground right now. But all the ones in the Central and the South are all existing. They are going to be replacements of old playgrounds that are.
Well, we'll want to hear some details about those playgrounds shortly, but if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. You've just been hearing me talking with Gene Kotlinski from Kansas City Parks and Recreation's South District, and we spoke by phone with Katie Vaughn, a researcher at Kansas State University. She's still with us, and we'll be bringing her back into the conversation about playgrounds and where they're located shortly. But I'd like to turn now to Amanda Stinger. She's taken matters into her own hands in order to ensure that her kids and others grow up with access to a neighborhood playground. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
So you live in Kansas City's Skerritt Renaissance neighborhood in the historic Northeast, right?
Correct.
Where are you from and what brought you to that neighborhood?
I'm from Parkville originally, and we moved to the neighborhood because of all the park space. So Kessler Park runs through the neighborhood. It has over 300 acres of great green park space. Cliff Drive runs through it, which is Kansas City's only urban byway. We're an outdoorsy family, and that's the main reason why we decided to buy there.
What inspired you to start mobilizing people in a campaign to build a playground?
Well, we have about 7,000 people in our neighborhood, and we don't have a playground. So when I first moved there, we didn't have children, and now I do. I have a 4- and 7-year-old. And while I can take my kids all over the city and do lots of fun things, I know that not all families can do that. And growing up in Parkville, I just sort of took it for granted. Every neighborhood had a playground. But our neighborhood doesn't have a playground. There's no place for these kids to be able to walk to do something as simple as swing on a swing. Also, we're really working on the quality of life in our neighborhood. So having a healthy playground or having a playground is a fundamental part of having a healthy neighborhood. It's a place where people can go and organically meet one another. Kids can meet kids. Families can meet each other in. That's how you start to develop those social ties.
You mentioned that you moved to the neighborhood for the green space and that you're mm-hmm. an outdoorsy clan. What are some of the things that you and your husband did that now with children, maybe you're, why are those things now maybe insufficient?
Some things my husband and I did. Oh, well, yes. I mean, we've blazed paths through the woods. We love to go on bike rides down Cliff Drive. And while those things we still do, not everybody is that type of person. And I mean, selfishly for my own kids, I want them to have a playground. And when we decided to do this, we sort of went big in Parks and Recs, dreaming, that is, on if we're going to do this, let's bring in a great playground. And Parks and Rec have been so supportive in the plans that we want to do. For example, we're going to have a 50-foot embankment slide this year.
I want to jump in here and get back to the plans in a second, because I'm curious how you just, as a parent who is not a politician or city employee, mm-hmm. how did you know where to begin you have this idea, but you can't just snap your fingers and make a playground exist. A lot of people might just grumble about it.
Right. I didn't know, but I knew that other neighborhoods had it, and I knew that communities make this happen. And so if they could do it, we can do it. And it was just a matter of figuring it out and talking to people and learning about PIAAC. And
Can you explain what that is, what PIAAC is?
Sure. It's the Public Infrastructure Advisory Committee, PIAC. And so it's for people who live in Kansas City, we have this little bucket of taxes that gets put every year, and the Public Advisory Committee decides what public projects, it's usually infrastructure and park projects, things that will benefit the public, how they're going to spend that money every year. So we ended up working with Parks. From the beginning, Parks was on board with us having a playground in Kessler in Skerritt where we wanted it. And they advised us to pitch for PIAAC and to do it in a phase. So PIAAC funds will be phased out over – the project will be phased over years. So we needed to prioritize our project. And that's how we pitched it. And it's a very simple application that you do online, and then you do a simple pitch in person. And City Council divvies out the money. And we were lucky our first year to get funded for it.
Are you getting enough funds to build the playground of your dreams through this process, or have you had to reach for other resources as well?
We have reached for other resources. We didn't get our full PIAAC request, but I'm not complaining. I'm happy that we got enough to get us started. And so we also were funded through a grant called Community Capital Fund, and we did a crowdfunding campaign. So in total, we're going to have enough to, for this year, we'll have the 50-foot embankment slide that I mentioned, some swings and some landscaping. And we'll pitch for PIAAC again this year, and hopefully we'll get funded again, and we'll continue the process.
What are the other features of this park that you hope will exist, of the playground?
Well, the actual playground structure itself is what we would like to see. So a 2-5 and a 5-12, you know, the playground structure is the big chunk that will be our next step.
So you mentioned that you have to prioritize all of these different things that you want to do. And it sounds like the embankment slide is a huge priority. Is that where you're starting?
It is where we're starting. We see that as the anchor for our playground. So as I mentioned, we decided to go big. If Skerritt needs a playground, we have all of this wonderful green space around us. Let's not only bring our kids a playground, but let's try to make it a playground that's so great that other people want to come to Skerritt for as well. So come to our neighborhood, take your family, ride down Cliff Drive. It's closed on the weekends. It's a beautiful drive. And then stop by and come on the awesome playground with the 50-foot embankment slide.
So we've said the term embankment slide several times, but what is that?
So it's a hill. It's a natural hillside that goes down into the area where the playground structures will be. And looking at it, we thought that it would be a great place for a slide. So we're having a local design firm custom design us a slide that we're just putting right on top of the hill slope.
So it's created to complement the natural features of that particular area.
Correct.
Is that how it usually works?
Embankment slides?
No, actually, Jean Kotlinski, could you tell us a little bit more about, is it typical that a design firm customizes a playground and its features to the land?
Well, the embankment slide is a little unique. It'll be the first one here in Kansas City. But yeah, that's generally how the process works. I mean, when we get funding for a playground, usually it is, you know, designed by our professionals in the field or either our professionals in our planning division, our architects and engineers. So, yeah, it playgrounds are designed because you have to have, you know, the fall zones and all this stuff that is required safety-wise laid out. And, yeah, it's part of the process of a new playground. It's designs as well.
So you've mentioned some other things, Amanda, other than just the embankment slide, which sounds like a huge undertaking on its own. What are some of these other things, and how did you set about prioritizing them so that you could get funding for one piece and then another? And how long will this entire process take?
Sure. It's probably going to take 3 years. And as Jean mentioned, Gina, you said that the embankment slide sounded complicated. When I got into it, I thought that it would be easy. I mean, it's just building a platform down a hill. How hard could it be? But in fact, with all the safety protocols that we need to adhere to and making sure we also have to think about ADA compliance, the safety surfacing on playgrounds are actually a third of the price of the playground equipment itself. So it has become a lot more complicated than I was anticipating from the beginning, but as these projects usually go, I guess. In addition, though, to your question, we'll have the embankment slide and then some swings with hopefully an ADA compliant swing this year. And then we'd like to, there's currently right now, there's some dilapidated basketball courts and then also four underutilized tennis courts. So we're going to move the basketball courts over to the tennis courts and add two more basketball hoops. So we'll have four basketball hoops and then also a small sided soccer field, a tennis field, and a multi-purpose field. So those four tennis courts will be used in that way. And then we'll take out where the current basketball court is and put in playground structures with the safety surfacing we hope will be natural or will be artificial turf.
But back to this question of prioritization.
All right.
How did you decide? How did you figure that all out? Did you get together a group of people in your neighborhood to kind of vote on how urgent the needs were or
what people wanted? Yeah, this all the way through this process, it's been a resident-defined project. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't a small group of people doing what they thought that people would like, but we've really tried to reach out as much as possible and figure out what people's priorities are. For example, the basketball court right now is the most utilized piece of equipment in that area. And so people were getting really concerned when we started talking about taking it out, and we had to address those concerns. No way, we're not removing it permanently. We're in fact, we're making your basketball court better and we're adding two more goals. So it was just a matter of getting feedback and doing a lot of meetings and in trying to hear what people wanted.
And you mentioned that all of this needed to be ADA compliant. That's Americans mm-hmm. with Disabilities Act.
Correct.
How so? Every feature of the playground will be ADA compliant?
No, my understanding is we need to take some reasonable measures to make it ADA compliant. For example, we need to make sure that there's ADA cutouts in the sidewalks, and we need to have some equipment that's ADA compliant at the playground, which honestly, whether or not that law exists, we know that we have disabled people in our neighborhood that we want that them to be able to come to this playground and have something for them to enjoy as well.
You sound very knowledgeable about the details of playground construction now. How has your journey what has your journey taught you that maybe you were surprised by other than how complicated it is to build an embankment slide?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the price has been shocking. I had no idea that playground equipment is so expensive. I mean, I mentioned our original PIAC request, and the Parks and Rec helped us with that, and we prioritized it out for 4 years, actually. And that total request, which included infrastructure, sidewalks, ADA cutouts, the playground equipment of our dreams, and a permanent bathroom, was $614,000.
Wow.
Yes.
And so you've talked about that you're going to do this over phases. How much for just the embankment slide piece of it?
We have about $100,000 this year, and I'm not sure how that's all going to be divvied, but we hope to get the elements I mentioned previously in this year with that money.
And how you said 3 years for mm-hmm. all of this to be completed?
Mm-hmm.
How old are your kids now, and how old will they be by the time this project is done?
I know. I hope they'll still enjoy it. They're 4 and 7.
And do you have advice to parents in other neighborhoods?
My advice is to dive in and figure it out and get it done. We all pay taxes into PIAC, so why not ask and to get build your coalitions? It took us. We started this in 2011. Just started, figuring out who we needed to talk to, who we needed to make relationships with, what the community wanted. Going through the formal steps of getting our neighborhood association on board, its residents on board, the neighboring neighborhood associations and their residents on board. And PIAC is not hard. It's, like I said, it's a very simple online application.
You're listening to Central Standard, and when we get back from our short break, we'll want to hear from you. We want to know what you're seeing in the parks in your neighborhood. Are there playgrounds? Are they in good condition? And what about other park amenities like water fountains, restrooms, and park lamps? Tell us what you are seeing and what you'd like to see. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Amanda Stinger and Gene Kotlinski. Amanda's a neighborhood resident who's worked hard to bring a playground to the parks of her neighborhood. And Gene is here with us from the Parks and Recreation Department of Kansas City, Missouri. We're also on the phone with Katie Vaughn, who's a K-State researcher who's participated in a study that found that while low-income neighborhoods in Kansas City, Missouri have more parkland than other neighborhoods, they also have fewer playgrounds. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Call us up and tell us about the playgrounds in your neighborhood, whether you've got them and what condition they're in. We'd like to also know things you'd like to see that you don't already. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to join the conversation, or tweet us at KCURCST. And Katie Vaughn, listening to this conversation, is there anything that jumps out at you that really confirms sort of the things you saw in your research, or maybe gives you some ideas about where people out in the community can go with the work that you've done and the findings you've unearthed?
After listening to Amanda, it just sounds so ideal. Everything that we would have wanted a citizen to do with any of the research and how to go about getting a playground in your community if you don't like the findings that you've seen that we've found. It just is wonderful to see such active citizens.
And Katie, we've heard... go on.
Oh, no.
Well, we've heard about some of the maybe what a person might consider to be negative findings, that there are neighborhoods where the public lands don't have playgrounds or don't have sufficient playgrounds. But I wonder if you found any hidden gems of playgrounds in or parks in neighborhoods that people wouldn't know about if they didn't live there.
There were a lot, and I can't pull any names out right now. It would been a couple of years since I've been up there, and I've been a little bit out of touch with some of my research in this area. But there were lots of little pocket playgrounds within parks that we had no idea about. It's hard to just look at a list, such a daunting list of 219 parks, and wonder what sort of amenities they have. So that's really also what we were hoping to accomplish, was to really bring to light all the wonderful amenities that may be hidden just in a list of parks.
What do you mean? How would you describe a pocket park? That's a phrase you just used, and that's a curious phrase, or a pocket playground.
That would just be a littler park, one that may be 1 to 2 acres just within a neighborhood. That maybe it's on a lot that used to contain a house, and now it's just a little green space, or there's just a little playground, and you wouldn't know it unless you drove by.
And you found lots and lots of those in Kansas City, Missouri? Or just a few?
Not necessarily lots, but there were a pretty big handful of them. And, I mean, to me, that's impressive. And that's exactly what you want. You just want a little place to meet up as a neighborhood and that you feel safe sending your kids to play and get some physical activity.
You mentioned earlier in the show that that having a lot of colors on a playground made kids want to stay longer. Are there any other park features that might surprise people to hear that those features, like little details, influence how well a park is used and for what duration?
Yeah. What we've kind of found is that parks have to have a balance of amenities that facilitate active play and that also let you rest. Because if everything that's at a park just is encouraging activity and there's no places to just sit and have a picnic or sit in the shade and rest, then people will go home as soon as they're tired. And so having picnic shelters with grills or drinking fountains and that sort of thing can really help make the difference in helping people really make it a park outing and not just a place to go for an hour or half an hour.
Let's bring in our callers on this subject. We've invited them to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. And we've still got lots of room for people, but we've got some calls lined up that we're ready to go to. Let's talk to Jenny in Brookside. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I was just calling in to, for a couple reasons. One, while I had Gene on a chance for Parks and Recreation, I wanted to publicly thank the city for the parks that we have. My main memories of growing up are from the parks. We swam at Arbor Villa. I grew up by Arno. And now my family lives at 55th and Main, basically. And within a mile, there's four parks that we can go to. And we can go to Loose Park, Triangle Park, Brookside Park, and one park, I don't even know the name of it. It's just a park by the school. But I appreciate it, and it's been a great thing. And then I wanted to also tell your speaker that I wouldn't worry about her, I mean your guest, that I wouldn't worry about her kids outgrowing it, because my kids are 12, 11, and 9, and we go to the parks all the time. So she doesn't need to worry.
Do you have, are there playgrounds in all those little parks you mentioned in Brookside?
Yep. Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like...
In fact, the one at Suicide Hill, they just put in a sand volleyball court, too, which I see people on all the time. So,
do you feel like that affects how you feel about the quality of life in your neighborhood overall for people other than the kids playing on those playgrounds?
I feel a little guilty. I just have always had it. I don't know what it's like to not have it. So it's something I have taken for granted, and just this conversation has made me feel I really need to appreciate this. Because it's something that we have, and it's just always been there, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for calling, Jenny.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Jean Kotlinski, do you often get to hear that kind of feedback from people, or is it one of those things where when things are working right, you don't hear about it as much as maybe when there's a complaint or a criticism?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, we don't get to hear those great comments. The Brookside area does fortunately have some great little pocket parks as we were talking about. Like I said, the Brookside Triangle is just a couple-acre park with a great little playground for 2 to 5-year-olds. Brookside Park is a great park. Again, I mentioned the sand volleyball court just got put in. It's a great playground. Of course, it's the sledding hill during the winter months, so it's a great neighborhood park. There's another little pocket park just north of that park called Countryside Park, just a half-acre park with just a great little playground as well. So it's a very fortunate part of town. It's actually one of the bigger draws of why people live in Brookside is because of the parks.
Do you think that there's anything we can learn from a neighborhood like Brookside to maybe help bring those kinds of features to other neighborhoods that have fewer things like that?
Well, again, it's neighborhood involvement, getting to know your city council person so you understand the PIAC process. Each city council person has PIAC representatives. We talked to about the pitch. I mean, basically, every June, July, August, is when the PIAC meetings are. You go to a meeting, submit your requests. You don't necessarily have to do that in person. You fill out the forms, and try to get the funding. The funding here that we're talking about is going to take 3 years because, there's lots of people come to these, they're not necessarily asking for playgrounds or looking for, other infrastructure improvements in their neighborhood and things like that. So the money has to be spread through all the requests, and sometimes the funding is available, and sometimes it takes a number of years to finish the project that gets funded.
Do you does Parks and Rec do any community outreach to let people in various neighborhoods know about this process and how it works and that they can have a voice in it?
We do get invited to neighborhood association meetings we do have a process that we try to get out to neighborhoods and talk about this process and other processes of trying to improve your playgrounds or improve your parks.
We have a message from Jill on Facebook who writes, "Parks are the most important part of where we choose to live, parentheses, in Northeast Overland Park, because there are so many parks to walk to. I think Prairie Village does the best job at great parks, but the disparity of parks in other parts of the metro is legit." And Jean, I guess we haven't really asked you, do you think that this is a legit observation and concern?
Oh, I definitely think so, yes.
Let's go ahead and hear from Joe in North Kansas City. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Not the same Joe on Facebook, just definitely. But actually, I just got back from a park with my 2-year-old son up in Gladstone called Happy Rock Park, and they have a really cool, 2.0 playground where it's this kind of structure that has these lights that you can hit and play different games with, and it seems to be pretty popular with the kids and some of the adults, too.
All right, well, do you have any advice for our listeners as far as picking a park or enjoying your neighborhood parks?
I don't know, something that is within driving distance or walking distance and has a bathroom, so that's pretty much it.
The importance of restrooms in parks. And Katie, that's something that your study examined, in fact.
Yes, it is. Restrooms and drinking fountains were two of the most important predictors of time spent at a park, especially with young children.
Katie, this is Amanda. I have a question about that. Restrooms is on our agenda for the park, but a concern we have, some transient will make their way through our park space, and we have a concern about the safety in that the restroom is being used for things other than it being a restroom. Did you come across in your research in a neighborhood where that could be a problem? Do you think we might be safer to just not have a restroom, or what would your advice be?
I'm sure that the park experts can speak to this a little bit better, but in some communities, they do lock the parks during the evening hours overnight to avoid those kind of situations. But I think it is overall really, really good to have a restroom in a park. Mm-hmm. So I definitely advocate for that, but obviously taking the proper safety precautions and really having the ground rules for the parks and the restrooms and enforcing them is really what's important.
Katie, do you have any sense of what other cities do in parks that have situations like what Amanda has described? Are there measures perhaps, have you ever seen a situation where neighborhood volunteers kind of take turns monitoring or anything like that?
I haven't seen it, but it sounds like a great idea. And I'm actually from California, and I know that in the town where I grew up, and a lot of the park restrooms were locked after a certain hour and then opened back up in the morning to try and avoid the situation of having people sleeping in the restroom or using it for uses other than it is intended.
Jean, what about you? What do you think is some are some appropriate measures to keep park restrooms safe and clean?
Well, you know, any park in the country, any park in the metropolitan area, you know, has a problem with anything. And if restrooms or any park, you know, public security is a key. I mean, you want to feel safe when you go to a park. And I think we have a good handle on that. Of course, you know, Kansas City, Missouri Police Department is our response for any security issues in our parks. And we encourage people to call 911 if there's a situation. But, you know, transient issues are you know, could happen in any park, and in any park in the metropolitan area. You know, we rely on the citizens, you know, to neighborhood watch programs and things like that to help out. But, you know, that's a tough issue, and that's an issue pretty much across the country.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Amanda Stinger of the Skerritt Renaissance Neighborhood, Jean Kotlinski of Kansas City Parks and Rec, and Katie Vaughn, a researcher at Kansas State University. She was involved in a study that found that there is a disparity of playgrounds in public parks in Kansas City, Missouri. And we'd love to hear from you, 816-235-2888, to join in this conversation that'll be going on for just a little while longer. We'd love to get you in. That number again is 816-235-2888. And we've got Kevin in Kansas City, Kansas on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yes. I respect both your guests. You're very knowledgeable, or all three, I'm sorry. But I was going to make a comment. This might sound a little like throwing a wrench in the thing, but our 614,000 for a playground. In other words, can't you put a swing in your backyard? When I used to go to the park, it was the nature aspect of it. Now, I wasn't looking for a swing, and I'm 60 years old, but I had a great park down the street from me, very small park, just on the Missouri side of State Line. I lived off State Line. And I believe it was Westwood Park. They had a great sledding hill. And, I mean, I don't remember anybody coming in and saying it had to be ADA compliant. And if you fell off your sled, you got hurt, or I don't know. You know, it's just, I'm not criticizing.
Yeah, you're just not convinced that this is a great use of funds.
Exactly. And well,
let's
secondly,
get some, yeah.
I mean, do the kids, when you go to the park, I used to love to go to Lewis Park and that park across from the Nelson Art Gallery. Kansas City, I think, has great parks and fantastic city for green space. And I grew up here. But exactly, Gina.
Well, yeah, let's go ahead and let our guests respond to this. What do you think, Amanda? Have you had a part of yourself that has wondered, well, we can raise $614,000. Is there a better use for this?
Absolutely. And honestly, I didn't really set out believing that we were going to be able to raise the whole $614,000. That's where we would start, you know, like any negotiations. But I love that the caller brings in the point about it's about the nature. And that's something I think I left out earlier, Gina, describing the park space is it's right across the street from 300 and some acres of wooded park space. And we really, from the beginning, wanted to bring in that nature element because I can tell you, wow, we have so many children in our neighborhood. Almost none of them are going into the woods. I mean, you just don't see that as much anymore.
Why not?
I don't know. I guess their parents didn't take them. It's just not something that they had ever done. There's been one time where we were in the woods where we actually got scared because it was a group of little boys with pop guns, and they were playing, you know, some type of game with guns in the woods.
But mostly you don't see other kids there?
No, we don't. And so we really wanted to make this playground space. We want it to be, you know, the user experience, so to speak, be one with the nature next to us. And so, you know, really have some well-designed landscaping elements.
Katie Vaughn, our caller, also mentioned that, you know, why can't you just put a swing set in your backyard? What's the difference between those two things, having a swing set in your backyard and going to a neighborhood playground?
Well, there's definitely the social component, and even folks who may see someone swinging at a playground across the street from the house, maybe they're more likely to go. And a playground that's public provides a lot of social support for the entire neighborhood and not just one family. Well, and I'd also like to add that I think kids these days are really dependent upon electronics, and if a playground is the gateway to getting kids out into the nature and the wooded part of the parks, then that's fantastic.
Let's hear now from Floyd in Plattsburgh. Hi, Floyd.
Hello. I would just like to add to the conversation. I think a gentleman earlier mentioned something to the effect of why are we spending so much money on parks when it's just as fun to go out and play. And I think that we've lost touch with the creative play and imagination. And I had just read an article in The Atlantic called the issue was called The Overprotected Child, and it reflected upon how in other parts of the world they have discovered that that creative play, such as building like adventure zones where there's like old tires and mattresses and just junk, actually promotes children to explore and take risks and be more creative with their time. And the playgrounds that we've had recently in the last 30, 40 years have always erred on the side of protecting the child from any harm, and in retrospect, this may have actually caused children to lose interest in going to parks.
Well, let's hear from our researcher about this, Floyd. I think this is a great comment and maybe fodder for a whole other show, in fact, Floyd's comments. But Katie Vaughn, could you weigh in on this? What is your sense of the relationship between the degree of protection provided in playgrounds and their benefits to children, either developmentally or socially?
I think that a lot of the ADA compliance, I think it's great because it gives kids who maybe physically can't get to certain parts of the park, it helps them access the park and be able to feel like a normal child too. And I think that is so important. But I think there is definitely an element of overprotection that is kind of in our culture now. And I think parks can help with that if they're designed properly with the children's best interests in mind.
Jean Kutlinski from the Kansas City Parks and Rec, are you often in this position of hearing from many different, you know, on the one hand, you've got people who want better playgrounds, more structure, more support, and on the other side, you have people who are saying, whoa, you know, could we back off? Could we leave the nature alone? Could we let our children create their own play?
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, we have 220 parks. And I think roughly 100, 110 playgrounds. So, yeah, not every one of our parks has a playground, but we have numerous ball fields, baseball fields, football fields. We have numerous tennis courts, fishing lakes. So, you know, green space, just for example, Loose Park. You go out to a loose to a weekend at Loose Park. Yes, we have the playground, which is very popular. We have tennis courts, which is very popular, but so much green space. People are out there just picnicking, throwing the football, throwing frisbee. So just using your imagination, flying a kite. So there's just the green space aspect of Kansas City parks that people really, that's where we lose track sometimes.
Let's hear from Janice and Lawrence. Hi, Janice.
Hello. I live in Lawrence, but I have grandkids in Kansas City, and I've really enjoyed numerous parks in the area for various reasons. My topic that I wondered about is specifically about playgrounds, and I know when I take my grandkids to the park, one of my first biggest considerations in the summer is the playground equipment shaded, because I find that either you can't even go at all, the equipment gets too hot, or else you know, they don't want to stay long if it's too hot. And I grew up in California where it wasn't really a consideration, and I realized here I almost don't understand why you would build playground equipment not shaded, because you really can't use it in the summer.
So, Katie Vaughn, what's your response to that? Do you think that shading is important?
Yes, and that was actually one of the aspects that we captured in the community park audit tool. And we were looking to see if at least two-thirds of the playground was shaded when it had direct sunlight. That is definitely a determinant of playground use and length of playground stay.
Okay, we're going to go to a caller just quickly, Sarah. We have just a second for your comment.
Oh, I just wanted to call and express my appreciation for Gillum Parks and Hyde Park. They're amazing. And I did not know about them until I moved to Hyde Park neighborhood. And I see kids out there all the time. I think this is right up a flight of steps. I think that they're underused. I wish more people knew about Gillum Park.
The Gillum Parks, could you tell us a note about that, Gene?
Yeah, Gillum Park is at the playground's at 41st and Gillum. So a brand new playground, probably within the last 5 years. It's a great place to come out.
That's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank Katie Vaughn, who participated in a study looking at the parks of Kansas City, Amanda Stinger, Skerritt Renaissance Neighborhood Association board member and chair of the Playground Committee, and Gene Kotlinski from Kansas City Parks and Rec. Thank you so much for being here. To listen back to any of our past shows, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You can stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @kcurcst. Tune in tomorrow at 10 as we explore the trials and triumphs of being a stay-at-home dad in Kansas City. A few of our own local dads have also contributed to a book called Dads Behaving Dadly. We'll hear about that tomorrow as well. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date.